No, I mean, I can't really think why you want to interview me at all. I mean, I've said everything worth saying in the book. I said to that research girl on the phone, Melissa or whatever her name is, I'm a very ordinary woman. I've led a rather dull life. I never climbed a mountain or swum the Channel or anything like that. I mean, you usually have some fascinating people on your programme, like that lovely ballerina who runs a day centre for the homeless. But she was most insistent. My publisher's over the moon, said it would boost the sales. There was talk of serialising the book in the Sunday papers, but it all came to nothing. As someone said only the other week, my only claim to fame is that I was Harry Kitchener's lover. Oh, thank you. Thank you. I wanted to put the record straight. People have been very cruel about him over the years, but I knew him better than anybody, even his own wife. Shirley didn't know him at all. Yes, I'm afraid she does come off rather badly in the book. I did my best to be objective, but I mean, well, you never met her. She was such a stupid woman. Still is a stupid woman. The children are no better. His daughter's a junior partner in a firm of creative caterers. And his son's a pork buyer for Waitrose. It would have been such a disappointment to him. Yes, Harry was a difficult man to live with, especially towards the end. He suffered from severe mood swings. You never really knew where you were. The doctor said Harry was a hypermanic depressive. That's the price you pay for being a genius, I suppose. Ordinary people suffer too, you know, I said to him one day. But it fell on deaf ears. I blame the British public for Harry's death, I really do. They idolised him throughout the 60s and then deserted him when his last series flopped. That's why he fled to Canada. He was seeking a kind of artistic asylum. Oh. I haven't said much about myself in the book. As I said before, I'm a very unremarkable woman. What you would call an underachiever. And besides, it's Harry's story. Though I do come from a theatrical background. My mother was an ex-gaiety girl. She married into the cream of aristocracy. They cut my father off without a penny when he announced he was marrying Mummy, but they were so in love, it didn't matter. They bought a little house on the Isle of Wight, near Ventnor. That's where I was born. They managed to earn a meagre living in the holiday season by taking people on tours around the island on a speedboat. Mummy used to sing the odd musical song while Daddy accompanied her on the mouth organ. Quite a novelty in its time. Mummy was a fund of stories about her days as a gaiety girl, but my favourite was one she told against herself. I had terrible trouble with my buzz, dear. Because in those days, you had to have a bosom in order to hang your jewellery upon it. Well, I had a pneumatic pair made, and they were a great success. And a very handsome guards officer asked if he might take me to dinner at Rules. He asked if he might give me flowers. Well, they were orchids, dear, with a magnificent diamond brooch. He pinned them to me. There was a small sigh of escaping air. One of my tits subsided, but the other remained magnificent. Yes, the theatre's always been in my blood. Artists aren't like other people. Mummy taught me that. An artist needs careful nurturing, or they just wither and die. I had Marty Jones. It used to come and stay with us when I was a child. Quite a popular act on the halls in her heyday. Used to wear men's suits before it became fashionable and smoked a pipe. But nobody minded. Of course, she was an artist. We all adored Auntie Joan. My brother Dale and me, that is. We longed for her visit. She was such fun. Life would be very dreary in Ventnor, even if it was by the sea. And the sheer energy of the woman. She must have been well into her 60s and nearly crippled with arthritis, but it didn't stop her from dragging us out of bed at the crack of dawn for a game of sardines. Auntie's philosophy on life was, if you don't give yourself time to stand still, the gremlins can't get you. though she did go into a decline when her friend died. Auntie came to visit us that summer, just before the war, but she'd lost her spirit. She told me she'd let the gremlins get to her. Now, there was no escape. I didn't know what she meant at the time, but I do now. We still played games, but to be honest, Gerald and I had rather outgrown Blind Man's Buff. This brooch belonged to her. Is it Limoges? I'm told it's worth a fortune. But I'd sooner starve than sell it. Harry never went in for jewellery, although Shirley used to be decked out like a Christmas tree. Every time he went back to her, he'd buy her another trinket or some ridiculous hat. Harry said, I didn't need anything to adorn me. He could be such a charmer when he wanted to be. No, he wasn't really a violent man. Harry wouldn't harm a fly. He never once laid a finger on me, except that once. And it was a complete accident. Harry hadn't meant to hit me at all. It was that stuck-up head waiter at the Mirabelle. I just happened to get in the way. Yes, he did break my jaw. He was absolutely mortified. He sent me flowers every day while I was in hospital. He would have come to see me, but he hated hospitals. You know, I never once shouted at Harry. I always found a dull, monotonous whine produced a much better effect. You see, Harry wasn't an alcoholic. Of course he drank. You couldn't have led Harry's lifestyle and not drink, but if you just got pissed once or twice in a public place, the press branded you as an alcoholic. The thing is, Harry was a very private person. I know everybody talks about those wild parties we used to have, but they were really quite tame affairs. That girl who ended up face down in the goldfish pond in Maidenhead was a gatecrasher. Nobody knew who she was. Anyway, she recovered and managed to sell her sordid little story. Shirley's no better. She remarried 6 months after Harry died. An accountant. They live in a ranch house in Harpenden. That story she sold to the newspapers was a pack of lies. She's lucky I didn't sue for libel. For a start, I was the secretary at Matthew Jennings, the solicitors, not Bowes and Underwood, when Harry met me. And I wasn't sacked. I left by mutual agreement with Mr. Jennings. It was all quite amicable. I was working with a girl called Marion, who was completely off her rocker. She said she was a brain surgeon at the age of 12. Used to scream rape in the lift. Wore the same beige suit in Cortel all the time I was there. They couldn't sack her. She was the managing director's stepdaughter, and she could type up to 140 words a minute. It was impossible trying to find another job after that. Besides, it was a full-time occupation just looking after Harry. No, I don't really regret never having any children. Look at the way Harry's have turned out. Mind you, what do you expect with Shirley as a mother? I'm afraid I'm rather like W.C. Fields. I like my baby as boiled. My mother said the people were only in mental hospitals because they wanted to be. Harry never wanted to be. They made me sign a form, said it was for his own good, said he was a danger to himself. He did try and kill himself. I'd only been out of the house for 10 minutes to get an evening paper and a cod in butter sauce, and there was blood everywhere when I got back. They sent him to quite a nice place. He was on one of those schemes overlooking the river. All the rooms had colour television. Very informal. All the nurses wore slacks. Not like the place I was thrown into once. Harry and I went on one of those weekend breaks to Venice, and we got very drunk the night we arrived, and I exposed myself to one of the local policemen. You know what Italians are like. They shoved me in a loony bin. The sight of those nuns force-feeding patients with spaghetti has remained with me ever since. That rather put pay to the rest of the weekend, I'm afraid. Harry had flown straight back to London. I understood perfectly the last thing he needed was bad publicity. Everywhere he went, Harry got a bad press. It was killing him. Harry's career was everything to him. It always came first. I understood that. Shirley didn't, of course. Shirley didn't understand anything. My publisher thinks it's a marvellous stroke of luck, BBC repeating Harry's first two series just as the book's about to come out. They're already talking about the paperback rights and the possibility of a film. I hope they get someone nice to play me. A proper actress, as opposed to one of those film stars, if you know what I mean. What I'm so thrilled about is a whole new generation will be able to appreciate him. Critics are now describing him as the first real alternative comedian. They keep saying he's politically correct. I really don't know what that means. But what he really cared about was making people laugh. He was always so good at playing the little man, the one who was constantly being browbeaten by the bureaucrat in the pinstripe suit. People identified with him. Strikes me you have to die before people really appreciate you. Exactly the same thing happened with Abbott and Costello. Harry's career would definitely have taken off if he just hung on. I was with him the night before he died, in his little room in Hornsey. I'd brought over a rug and a couple of prints to make the place a little bit more like a home. We'd decided, for the time being, we'd live separately. But he was in an exceptionally cheerful mood that night. Not in one of his black moods, thank God. Talked about divorcing his wife and phoning his agent, said he was determined to work again. He was full of plans. Said he was going to knuckle down and write his own series. He had this marvellous idea about a man who inherits a million but decides not to tell his family and just carries on working for the water board. So I couldn't quite believe it when he threw himself off Archway Viaduct the following day. But he was very much a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. 1 minute out and the next down. The doctor swore by this new drug, lithium. If only he'd hung on. Yes, I do hope the book's a success. Took me 7 years to write. Is your friend all set up? Are we ready for the off? Is that sort of thing you wanted to hear? Could I be a little kinder? I thought I was being kind. Very kind indeed.
By Marion Nancarrow.